जयो राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी। जय गोपी जन वल्लभ गिरिवर धारी। जय गोपी जन वल्लभ गिरिवर धारी। यशोर नंदना ब्रज जन रंजन। यशोरानंदना ब्रज जन रंजन। यमुना तीर वनचारी यमुना तीर वनचारी। जय हो राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी। जय हो राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी। जय गोपी जन वल्लभ गिरिवर धारी। जय गोपी जन वल्लभ गिरिवर धारी। यशोर नंदना ब्रज जन रंजन। यशोर नंदना ब्रज जन रंजन। यमुना तीर वनचारी। यमुना तीर वनचारी। जयो राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी। जयो राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी। जय ओम विष्णुपाद परमहंस परिव्राजकाचार्य स्तोत्र शत श्री श्रीमद इस डिवाइन ग्रेस लेसी भक्ति वेदांत स्वामी प्रभुपाद की जय। गुरंतराज श्रीमद भागवतम की जय। निताय गौ प्रेमानंदे हरि हरि बोल समवेत भक्त वृंद की जय। आगे सदी असेंबल डिवोटीज। आगे सदी असेंबल डिवोटीज। आगे सदी असेंबल डिवोटीज। आगे श्री श्री गुरु गौरांग। One time I gave the Sunday feast lecture on the Prima Dhoni prayers. Because so many devotees don't seem to understand what they mean. One of them I was really surprised, a devotee had been a devotee for like 40 years. He said, why are we glorifying the Samaveda? Well, it's not about the Samaveda. The word is Samaveda. Samaveda Yuktsava. Samaveda means assemble. Samaveda Bhaktavrinda means all glories to the assembled devotees. That's what it means. That's why we say all glories to the assembled devotees. Samaveda Bhaktavrinda ki jai. Not about the Samaveda. Anyway, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 16, Jai and Vijay, Cursed by the Sages. Verse number 16. Word meanings, Rishaya, the sages, Uchu, said, Na not vayam we, Bhagavan, O Supreme Personality of Godhead. I always wonder why sometimes it's Bhagavan and sometimes it's Bhagavan. Of course, I don't know Sanskrit, so I don't know the answer to that. Vidmaha, did know, Tava, your, Deva, O Lord, Chikirshitam, wish for us to do, Kritaha, has been done, May unto me, Anugraha, favor, Cha and iti thus, Yet which adyaksha, the supreme ruler, prabhashasi, you say. Rishaya uchu, na vayam bhagavan vidmas, tava deva chikirshitam. Krito me nugrahascheti yadadyaksha prabhashase rishaya uchu navayam bhagavan vidmas tava deva chikirshitam Krito me nugrahascheti yadadyaksha prabhashase rishaya uchu navayam bhagavan vidmas tava deva chikirshitam Krito me nugrahascheti yadadyaksha prabhashase navayam bhagavanvidmas Chikirshitam Kato me nukrashcheti Niradyaksha prabhashase Avadeva chikirshitam Nukrashcheti Niradyaksha prabhasati
Now
Translation. The sages said, O Supreme Personality of Godhead, we are unable to know, excuse me, we are unable to know what you intended for us to do, for even though you are the supreme ruler of all, you speak in our favor as if we had done something good for you. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The sages could understand that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is above everyone, was speaking as if he were in the wrong. Therefore, it was difficult for them to understand the words of the Lord. They could understand, however, that the Lord was speaking in such a humble way just to show them his all-merciful favor. Om jnanatimirantasya jnananjana shalakaya chakshurun militamena tasmai shri guruve namaha. So Lord Narayana has just finished speaking to the four Kumars, and this is their reaction. I was thinking how today we had the expression, wait, what? So it's kind of their response, like, wait, what? What did you just say? They're a little confused. They're not exactly clear. One thing, and maybe the Sanskritist here can correct me, but it seems like there's actually a direct quote here. Krito me nugrahas cheti. The iti is kind of like putting things in quotation marks. So actually, krito me, or me means my, right? Krito me nugraha. In other words, you gave me mercy, or you did some favor for me. It's directly, they're saying that, they're quoting him directly, although in the translation it's done as an indirect quote. So they're wondering, how did we do a favor for you? What's going on here? But it says here, they understood that the Lord was speaking in a humble way just to show him his all-merciful favor. And that's Prabhupada's insight into this. But what they're saying is that we're not really quite sure what we've done. We are unable to understand, to know what you intend to do. So Krishna speaks sometimes, he's not easy to understand. Even in Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna says, wait a minute, can you give it to me straight? You said this, but now you're saying this, and they seem like you're talking, first you're telling me that work, but then you're telling me to be a yogi and meditate, and I can't understand. So what does Krishna say? No, the two are the same thing. Get it? Actually, he has to repeat himself sometimes. So there's a, when I read this, I was thinking, there's a somewhat famous line, or a verse from the 11th canto, the Uddhava Gita, where Krishna says, I'm very fond of indirect instruction. Or might say parokshavada, it's called, difficult to understand. And let me see the verse if I have it here. I wrote down a bunch of things because I don't have anything to say today, so maybe I'll find something. Let's see. Oh, here it is. No, that's a different one. So here, Parokshavada. Oh, here it is. I'm sorry. It's the first thing I have here. This is from the 11th canto from the Uddhava Gita. Veda Brahmatma Vishayas Trikanda Vishaya Ime Parokshavada Rishaya Paroksham Mama cha priyam. The Vedas, divided into three divisions, ultimately reveal the living entity as pure spirit soul. The Vedic seers and mantras, however, deal in esoteric terms, and I am also pleased by such confidential descriptions. Now, in the word for word, the translation is indirect explanation, paroksham. Let's see, is parokshavada, where's the phrase? Parokshavada, speaking esoterically. So the idea this comes up is, well, different contexts. I was looking and trying to get more information on this idea, but I've seen it explained. Well, the first idea I had was that Krishna speaks in that way because he doesn't want everybody to understand, actually. You have to have some qualification to understand. So sometimes he speaks in such a way that the rascals won't understand. Like Prabhupada, there's one place Prabhupada has the phrase, something like, Krishna reserves the right of not being exposed to the rascals, something like that. He wants to stay hidden, he can stay hidden. So he sometimes stays hidden because of the way the rishis speak about him. They speak about him in esoteric language with a lot of, just like any subject that's you have to have some qualification to enter into. Different subjects, for example, they have their own jargon, as we say. Now, with jargon, it has a negative connotation, but jargon really means just the specific language of a particular area of study or a particular topic. So we certainly have tons and tons of jargon that people hear us, they don't know, even our English, what to speak of Sanskrit, they a lot of times don't understand what we mean by our words. So the Vedas are full of that kind of thing. That's one reason why the scholars, they don't understand what's going on, really. The Vedas, they certainly don't think there's a Siddhanta, that they're all leading to one particular thing, that there's an overriding theme to the Vedas, which is what Krishna is saying here. He said there is an overriding theme, but the rishis speak in such a way that sometimes people can't understand. So just like these scholars, they'll study the Rig Veda, this Veda, that Veda, the Brahmanas and the Upanishads and so on, Aranyakas, and they really can't make sense of it. It's because the times were so different. It was a different technology. It's like someone 150 years ago picking up a software manual, how to use Microsoft Word or something. What are they going to get out of it? They're not going to understand anything. So the rishis speak in such a way, and the Vedas are spoken in such a way that you have to have certain qualifications in order to understand it. Otherwise, you won't know what's going on. So of course we have the fate that our acharyas really knew what was going on, and Srila Prabhupada knew what was going on. Recently, I've been reading different commentaries on Bhagavad Gita. I read Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur's commentary and Baladev Vidyabhushan's commentaries, and now I'm actually reading Srila Prabhupada's. It's quite interesting, actually, to see how the different acharyas bring out different aspects and present, or you might say, yeah, present the message in different ways, actually. Because there's some... You can do that because of the way Krishna speaks. For one thing, words, Sanskrit words, many of them, you may have noticed, the same word has many definitions. It's like the word Atma. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, where Lord Chaitanya is explaining the Atmarama verse. So he gives definitions from different Sanskrit, different dictionaries, synonyms for these words. So if you look at Atma, then you'll see there's like, I don't know, six or eight different translations of the word Atma. And some of them, they don't seem to have anything to do with each other. We understand Atma, for example, there's Paramatma. Sometimes in the Vedas, of course, sometimes Atma refers to God. Sometimes Atma refers to the soul. Sometimes Atma refers to self in a kind of materialistic way, like I talk about myself. I'm thinking of this mundane personality. So it can be used in different ways. So Sanskrit words can be used in different ways, but translated in different ways. So similarly in Bhagavad Gita, I was thinking how Srila Prabhupada called his book Bhagavad Gita As It Is. So that as it is, it's not necessarily only one thing, actually. Of course, the bottom line is, Krishna's talking about devotion to himself. But you can translate the words in different ways. I was thinking of a good example. Now, what was the word I was looking at? Oh, bhavam. So bhavam is another one of these words. So mud bhavam, Srila Prabhupada translates it basically as bhava for me. But mud bhavam can just be my nature. The yogi can enter into my nature, or the jnani can enter into my nature, have some realization of my nature. But Prabhupada takes it, probably gives everything a direct Krishna conscious twist, you might say. Even when, if you read the commentaries of Baladev Vijayabhushan and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, they give really more of a technical explanation. Here Krishna is talking about nishkama karma yoga, and here he's talking about jnana and so on. So Prabhupada, he often covers those things, although he tends not to use the technical language. But then many of his purports, after he'll speak on something, then at the end he'll say, but if you're a devotee in Krishna consciousness, basically automatically accomplishes whatever this jnani or yogi is trying to accomplish. He gives everything this Krishna conscious purport, you can say, because the whole book, the overriding theme of the book is devotion to Krishna. There in Sanskrit or Vedic hermeneutics, you can call it, which means understanding the Vedas. This was actually developed by the Karma Mimamsa. There are six different ways. I don't know what they are off the top of my head. But you analyze a book, a literary work, in six different ways to understand what is it actually saying. What's the bottom line here? What's the purport of this thing? So I know one is, how does it begin? How does it end? What unique idea is presented in it? There are different ways to do it. So actually Vyasadeva, he followed this, and our acharyas, they follow this system of these six ways of looking at some literary work to try to understand it. It comes from the Purva Mimamsa. Mimamsa means to analyze, deeply analyze something. So the karma mimamsa, that means analyzing the Vedas. Their idea is that the Vedas are all the value of the Vedas is that they're injunctive. Injunctive means they give rules, they tell you what to do. And then when there are things that talk about devotion or this or that, that's not directly a rule, then that's more or less superfluous. We don't care about that. We care about what are we supposed to do. That's their conclusion. So everything they look at the Vedas from that lens. I mentioned not too long ago in another class, there's a place where it says, well, it's in the Bhagavatam. It says that Lord Brahma studied the Vedas three times. So Jiva Goswami says, first he looked at it through the karma lens, then he looked at it through the jnana lens, then he looked at it through the bhakti lens, and he concluded, actually the bhakti lens is the one that makes it, that's the one that's really focused in on what's being said in the Vedas. Actually, there's this verse that did I lose something here? Anyway, I'd stick things here and there. This Veda, what is the word? Hari Sarvatra Giyate. I'm looking for the word. That's the last line of it. And it's quoted in Chaitanya Charitamrita, where the source is not given. But it comes from from what I understand, it comes from the Hari Vansha, and I think it's also in another place. I forget, another Purana. Anyway, the idea is that all of the Vedas, Hari Sarvatra Giyate, they're meant for glorification of Hari, Lord Krishna. So that's really what it's all about. So even when Krishna speaks, or Krishna or the sages, they speak in these different ways, in these esoteric ways. Now they have different purposes in doing it. Like I said, one of the reasons is because you have to qualify yourself to gain entry into what's being said here. And the other is that they're trying to encourage people to take up the Vedas, and they're not giving the direct thing. They're not giving the direct message right away. Just like, we in our preaching, we might say, in book distribution, this book is about such and such, and we don't come right out and say, this book is about you giving up your material life, stop being a karmi, a meat eater, and surrender to Krishna. We might say, you'll learn how to cook with this or something, or whatever. Actually, I remember there was a walk in Berkeley where the devotees were talking with Prabhupada about that, using different lines, and someone said, because back in the day, in the old days, the books were coming out, and we were distributing whatever it was, Chaitanya Charitamrita Volume 1, or whatever, So someone said something like, Prabhupada, maybe tell them, there's recipes in there. So there are lists of all the things that are offered to Krishna, how to make Bengali sweets, you know. So some devotee said, yeah, Chaitanya Charitamrita is the Bengali sweet, actually. The book itself is the Bengali sweet. So the point is that sometimes things are stated in a certain way where you don't just like hit the nail on the head. So as I was looking at this idea about Parokshavad, it comes up in the context of encouraging people to perform Vedic sacrifices, just like Vyasadeva did, of course, in his books. And but he wasn't satisfied, of course, but that was, you know, he had a purpose in doing it, even though Narada Muni was kind of heavy with him. He said, this is condemned, what you have done, encouraging people in these things. But this is the idea of Parokshavad, is that it's meant to encourage people. Parokshavad, this one quote I wanted to get. This is from Dr. Obiel Kapoor from an old Back to Godhead article. It was called The Path of Bhakti. I think it was in 1974. Dr. Obiel Kapoor, I assume you know, he's Prabhupada's godbrother. His name is Adi Keshava Das, actually. But this is a little something that he wrote. Let's see. It may be added that if only disinterested actions are useful for liberation, how shall we explain the Vedic injunctions regarding the performance of ceremonial rites apparently aimed at worldly enjoyment? So the context must be, he was talking, just like Krishna does in Bhagavad Gita, disinterested actions. Krishna's always, you know, repeatedly he makes this point in Bhagavad Gita, you have to act without being attached to the results. I always wonder, well, what is the practical application of that exactly? Another thing I'm finding, when I was talking about how words can have different meanings, even English words, like Prabhupada uses the word work a lot, this work, that work, and you wonder, is he just talking about a person's job? It doesn't seem that way in the context. It's talking about action, actually. Any activity, any work has a karmic reaction. So it's not just the job, it's anything you do is karma, it's work, and it has a reaction. So he's talking, he says, if only disinterested actions are useful for liberation, in other words, being detached from the results of your actions. Oh, another point I was going to say, this idea, which is appears quite heavily in Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary, this idea of nishkama karma yoga, doing your work. One thing is, technically, actually, we now in the modern age, we can't actually do nishkama karma yoga, because what nishkama karma yoga is technically, as you do your karmic duty within varnashram, every day you're supposed to do this, you light your sacrificial fire, you do this yajna, that yajna, and so on. But then you're detached from it. You know, how exactly, but somehow you're detachment. Of course, the idea is you offer it to Krishna. So actually, we can't actually really do that, our sub-nishkama karma yoga. But he talks about it a lot. So when I hear about this, I think, well, gee, that sounds harder than bhakti yoga. Bhakti yoga is the highest thing, but nishkama karma yoga sounds like it's harder. It's supposed to be easier. It's on the lower stage. Just offer the results of what you do to Krishna. And I think, well, gee, that's not a very easy thing to do. Come on, you know, put my paycheck in the hundi every month. What does that mean exactly? Actually, I was just reading where Prabhupada was in one purport where he talks about basically having no care for taking care of ourselves, essentially. He says like that in the purport. Actually, there are many places I come across these things and I think, you know, if you just pull that line out from Srila Prabhupada, it's like, whoa, because he doesn't always qualify what he says. You know, you have to, that's why I was saying, well, that's a good reason you have to read everything, because you just pick up one section. Just like I was reading in Chaitanya Charitamrita in one purport, I think it was in the context of Lord Chaitanya was angry at Govinda because he was keeping some haritaki, and he had more than a day's worth. So Lord Chaitanya was chastising him, don't keep anything for the next day. So the purport Prabhupada just talks about that, and he says the householder should not store food for the next day. Really? You're supposed to live like that? I mean, maybe if you're in India and you go to the bazaar every morning or something, maybe, but it's hard to imagine. But he doesn't qualify. You have to look somewhere else to get some qualifying thing. So anyway, so let me get back to what I was reading here. This is Dr. Kapoor. He says, how should we explain the Vedic injunctions regarding the performance of ceremonial rites apparently aimed at worldly enjoyment? Because the Vedas actually tell you to do these things. The answer is that the real object of Vedic injunctions is not to produce attachment to worldly objects, but gradually to wean us out of them by permitting only restricted use of them and by offering counter-attractions. The ceremonial rites enjoined in the Vedas are therefore called paroksha kriya, and the shastras expounding the performance of karma are called paroksha vada. So the Uddhava Gita, where this phrase comes up, paroksha vada, I was thinking more, the rishis use paroksha vada, but the rishis are also teaching Vedic sacrifice. So they may do this. This is also called artavad, which, you know, one of the offenses to the holy name is non-artavad. You're not supposed to. Artavad means exaggeration. That's another way to use the term. Artavad is exaggeration. Just like in the some of these Vedic sacrifices, you know, it says that you'll be immortal. Amrita. The idea is there. You'll become deathless by doing this particular thing or that particular thing. Well, literally, it's not true, actually, because you're going to have to come back here. But it's a really long time, so we can say you're going to live forever. From our perspective, okay, it's like that. But it's not literally true. So that's the idea. Now, another way this is used, this term is used, I found it in, as I was looking at this, is in the teachings of Tuparanjana, where it said that the allegory is called Parokshavad. And there, Prabhupada, it's interesting because I think they seem to be at different ends of the spectrum. One is that Parokshavad is there so that you can't quite penetrate it. But on the other side, Prabhupada says Parokshavad, if you use allegory, it's so that people can understand. This is like we use metaphors all the time. We use analogies all the time. So those are also called Parokshavad. Because you're not literally, you don't literally mean what you're saying. You're using it in a kind of, you know, an allegorical way. Now, the whole story of Paranjan. Of course, it's interesting because when it's done, then King Paranjan says, when he hears the story, he says, maybe some advanced souls can understand this, but a karmi like me, I didn't quite get what you were talking about. Can you explain all this to me? So, of course, then it becomes clear, oh, now I see. That's what that was about. That's why you're saying that. Actually, one interesting thing about if you read that whole Paranjan, those chapters, you think, well, okay, so Paranjan is the soul, and his wife is the material intelligence. So there's all these different kinds of interactions between Paranjan and his wife. So you would think, well, this is a metaphor for the relationship between the soul and the material intelligence. But a lot of times it's not taken like that. Prabhupada just takes it on the surface level as if it's just two ordinary people doing something, and he comments on how what they're doing in the material world is wrong or something like that. So it seems like the theme of it being a metaphor and all the way through, it doesn't seem to hold up. And I've read Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on that section too, and he doesn't necessarily explain everything in that way. Because I'm thinking, of course, that's one thing that Narada Muni does at the end. He says, so this, you know, these soldiers represent this, and the chariot represents this, and so on. So he does much of that. But a lot of the interaction between the husband and wife is not necessarily, there's no purport from an allegorical point of view. So let's see, there was something else. Actually, I skipped. I was going to start this class in a different place. Oh, I was going to talk about Krishna's qualities, about how he speaks, because they're bewildered here by how Krishna is speaking. So one of Krishna's 64 qualities is that he's fluent, which means that he can speak any language. And it also says, let's see, Krishna's speech is described by Uddhava. The words of Krishna are so attractive that they can immediately change the heart of even his opponent. His words can immediately solve all the questions and problems of the world. Although he does not speak very long, each and every word from his mouth contains volumes of meaning. So that's why the acharyas can draw volumes of meaning from the same words. Sometimes I wonder about this because you think, I mean, my natural reaction is, well, if Krishna's speaking, it seems like he's trying to say something in particular. But apparently, Krishna can say many things in particular at the same time. Of course, he's God. He can do unlimited things. So different people are receiving his words in different ways. And they're somehow all authorized. They're all bona fide. Krishna can do that. He can do the inconceivable. So here's how also Krishna's a pleasing talker. So there the example is given that when he, after he chastised Kaliya, then he spoke nicely to him. He said, I'm sorry, but I had to do this because I had to protect my friends and my cowherd, the cowherd boys. So, you know, don't take it too hard. let's see. There was that. I guess I'll just, this is, by the way, this is Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on this verse today. Though they had understood, they again, in other words, the Kumaras, though they had understood, they again asked questions in order to hear from the mouth of the Lord his intentions. So they understood on somehow, but then they were thinking, well, could he really have said that? I mean, so then he's quoting, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is quoting, we do not know your intention, whether you want to be merciful to us or want to punish us, since you, the Supreme Lord, say to us that we have shown mercy to you, and since that is impossible, wanting to punish us, you first joke with us. So that's one way they're taking, you're just joking, Krishna, right? We didn't really do something good for you. Or maybe, desiring to favor us to help spread dharma that you created, since you favor brahmanas, you actually are praising us. Please tell us your intention toward us, since we are ignorant and unable to understand what you desire. I remember what else I printed out here, but I seems like it got lost on the way here or something. I was going to bring up the point, which is interesting, that sometimes in the Acharya's commentaries, oh, this is it here. This is Vishwanath Chakravarti's commentary on the 29th verse of this chapter. So this is the verse. This is Bhanu Swami's translation. The Lord spoke to his two associates, go to the material world, do not be afraid. You will have good fortune, but also do not go to that world. Though I can nullify the curse of the Brahmana, I do not desire to go against my own rules. So this sounds like an example of Parokshavad, right? Go to that world, but don't go to that world. So this is what Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says. I mentioned recently that the view that we generally get of the Chatur Shloki Bhagavatam is that Lord Narayan spoke it, Lord Vishnu. But Jiva Goswami gives evidence that actually Krishna himself spoke the Chatur Shloki Bhagavatam. And he gives his arguments. So this is Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. He's going to make an argument about something here. Seeing that Jaya and Vijay had just arrived, I don't know why, the Lord spoke, go to the material world. Seeing them weeping and wailing, the Lord again spoke to them, his heart softened by compassion. Do not fear. May you too have good fortune. Do not go there. Always remain serving me in Vaikuntha. The negative word ma can be used with both yatam and baishtam. Those are from the verse. Seeing that they were not happy, he said, though I can nullify the curse of the Brahmana, I do not desire to destroy my promise. I have made a rule to accept the inevitability of a Brahmana's curse. Just as Garuda sacrificed an expansion of his wing in order to maintain the inevitability of the thunderbolt's power, you should take on the role of demons in one of your expansions and at the same time remain in Vaikuntha in your swaroops. Later this passage is found. So he quotes a verse, three verses from the 8th canto, chapter 21, verses 15 through 17. O King, when the associates of Lord Vishnu saw that the soldiers of the demons coming forward in violence, they smiled. So this is, there's a battle going to take place between the demons and the demigods. Taking up their weapons, they forbade the demons to continue their attempt. Nanda, Sunanda, Jai, Vijay, Prabala, Bala, Kumuda, Kumudaksha, Vishwaksena, Paritra, Patatrirat, Garuda, Jayanta, Sutadev, Pushpadanta, and Satvata were all associates of Lord Vishnu. They were as powerful as 10,000 elephants, and now they began killing the soldiers of the demons. So this is the end. This Vishwanath Chakravarti says, in the narration of, so that's one example where Jaya and Vijaya are on the scene. And then in the narration of Vamana and Bali, Jaya and Vijaya are mentioned among the associates of the Lord fighting. But after being born as Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu, they would later be born as Ravana and Kumbhakarna. The explanation of their expansions must be given in order to resolve the contradiction of being simultaneously in the form of demons and associates of the Lord. So did you get that? The idea is that while Jai and Vijay were in the material world playing roles of demons, different episodes took place. Lord Vishnu was in this world doing different things, and Jai and Vijay were with them. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says the only way to explain it is the demon forms were expansions of them. It wasn't actually that. So this is one of those things. You'll never hear this again anywhere. This is just Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur saying this. So it's quite amazing, actually. Because a lot of times the commentators, they try to, things that seem to be contradictory, they try to resolve these contradictions. If you read, I've been reading the Brihad Vaishnav Toshini, which is Sanatana Goswami's commentary in the 10th canto. So I think I mentioned this before, but he gives sometimes a half a dozen ways of interpreting a verse. He'll say something, then he'll say or, and then he'll say something else, and then he'll say or, and then he'll say something else, and then he'll say or, and he'll say something else. All of these different ways of looking at this, what Krishna is saying here, or these are, of course, 10th canto is Krishna's lila, especially when Krishna's speaking. He takes it in different ways, or even what Shukadev is saying. So it's a quite interesting thing. One thing, of course, it shows is things are not so simple. Right? Nothing is simple when you get right down to it. We're talking about Krishna. The Bhagavatam is Krishna. Krishna is multifaceted. That's another way to look at it. It's like the same jewel. Sometimes this example is used, the Vaidurya money. It's the same jewel, but it doesn't just give off, it gives off all different colors, depending on how you look at it. I came across one footnote in Bhanu Swami, one of his commentary translations, I think one of the Gita translations. He's trying to figure out which stone it might be. He said, maybe it's an opal, because sometimes an opal, if you look at it, you get to see some pink here and yellow here and purple here and so on. So Vaidurya money. So Krishna is Vaidurya money, he himself, and he can be seen in different ways. Of course, the classic example is Krishna in the wrestling arena, where, how many is it? 10, I think? Different people, and they see him in a different way, right? The fighter, wrestlers see him as the thunderbolt, and the Brijbasis see him as their friend in the village, and so on like that. So it's the same Krishna, but they're all seeing him in a different way. So Krishna's speech also, it can be taken in a different way, according to one's heart and one's realizations. Okay, I'll stop here. Read the verse again. Risha Uchu. Navayam Bhagavan Vidmastava Deva Chikirshitam Kritome Nugrahascheti Yadadyaksha Prabhashase. The sages said, O Supreme Personality of Godhead, we are unable to know what you intend for us to do, for even though you are the Supreme Ruler of all, you speak in our favor as if we had done something good for you. So, anything? Yes, Maharaj, Damodar Maharaj.
Thank you so much for insights. Probably a small percentage of what you said went over our heads, because you were throwing a lot of conceptual principles at us. But I got most of it. It seemed, without using the word, it seemed like you were presenting hermeneutics, the different ways to understand scripture. And one of the, that of course that was a big topic that came up a few years ago in on the Sastric Advisory Committee, and the one of the hints that we got from that those discussions was that scripture should be really best understood by understanding the intentions of the author, what the author actually intended. Sometimes that doesn't, you know, it's not so easy to catch that right away, but that should be the, you know, should be mm-hmm. the bottom line. I just wanted to suggest that. The I had something else, but I'm having a senior moment here.
I'm thinking of that example Prabhupada gave of, what was his name, the father of Aurangzeb? Shah Jahan. Yeah, so there's a book called Shah Jahan. It's all about Aurangzeb's atrocities. So Prabhupada said, someone asked the author, why did you call it Shah Jahan when it's all about Aurangzeb? And the author said, well, it's about Shah Jahan because he had to suffer so much because of the atrocities of his son. And Prabhupada gave this as an example of the author knows what the book is about. So he gave this as an example of the kind of thing that you're talking about. He understood the purpose of the title of the book, at least in that case.
So it seems like, you know, when we leave this class, we should also include for ourselves a word of caution that although there are many different angles of vision, maybe we should just follow the mood of Srila Prabhupada, Bhagavad Gita as it is. Mm-hmm. There's so many interpretations. Shiva Ramaswamy wrote this book about the Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita purports. And
that's a hard book to read. I tried to read it years ago.
It gets a little technical there. Structured, too much structure.
Yeah, you have to remember this corollary and that and all these different things.
So,
but yeah, of course, you know, there can be so many commentaries. Even like, just like, you know, Vishwanath, Baladev is at least the, you know, Shiksha relationship with Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. So he wrote a Bhagavad Gita right after, or you know, on the tales of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary. So he certainly has fidelity to his guru and has great respect for him, devotion for him. But some of the things he wrote are different, actually. Some of his interpretations are different. So, because when you're, I think for, you know, for us, it, in one way, we have to be, it helps us to be broad-minded, not to think that everything has to be exactly in black and white. We know also, of course, Krishna says, you can't know me without devotion. Ultimately, things are revealed by devotion, not by our intellect. So, you know, ultimately that's what you understand. You know, it's revealed from within the heart, really. But still, we're meant to study. Prabhupada said, scrutinizingly study. So, of course, I find when I do that, I run into all kinds of problems.
The Bhagavad Gita, as it is, Prabhupada called it.
Yeah.
Bhagavad Gita, that there certainly there has been, and probably still going on, so many different versions of Bhagavad Gita, so many interpretations.
Yeah.
Prabhupada gives the example of one doctor interpreted the whole thing as a discussion between a doctor and his patient or something like that. But Bhagavad Gita as it is, for us at least, hopefully for others, it could be like the archetype of how to interpret, if we want to use that word, interpretation.
Now, one thing is, of course, you know, every teacher has their goal. So Prabhupada had a specific purpose in mind when he was writing the Bhagavad Gita, when he was writing his commentaries, purports. So he was thinking of his audience, obviously. I mean, it's of course, it's obvious who he was thinking of. And he was writing, you know, for us. And of course, it had its effect. So many thousands of people became devotees. They're still becoming devotees. So, you know, it's true that some of our acharyas are also, just like Jiva Goswami, he's not writing for us, generally
speaking.
The
other thing is also there, there's objectivity as well. In other words, Prabhupada's criticized, everything Krishna says, you always interpret as bhakti, in the bhakti tradition. Yeah. Why you do that? But then, so that may seem like a prejudice or a certain sort of default mode that Srila Prabhupada is taking of devotion. But then on the other hand, if we look at Bhagavad Gita, the end of so many chapters, it always comes out to the same thing, devotion to Krishna. So it could, on one hand, one could make an argument that it's Bhaktivedanta Swami's way of interpreting, he's prejudiced in favor of the bhakti idea. But then on the other hand, if we actually look at the Bhagavad Gita, it seems to corroborate, it seems to completely support the conclusion of devotion to Krishna as the bottom line.
Yeah. Now, actually, Prabhupada, he did, right in the beginning of the book, he says why he's presenting this Bhagavad Gita, because there's so many other presentations of it that are bogus, basically. And he says, so I'm here to set the record straight, you might say. So that was certainly part of his, he was countering all these bogus things, bogus interpretations, written by demons, he would say. So yeah, obviously that was there. And of course he was also speaking in a language that we could understand without using a lot of technical terms. So he was presenting it for us, and he was presenting the message very clearly. No, these people are not presenting, they're missing the spirit of the Gita, Prabhupada said. So that, so he wrote it so we would understand. You can't miss the point, obviously. You read Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita, obviously it's all about devotion to Krishna. Actually, I was thinking too, a lot of times we say, we think of it sometimes maybe as a progression. This is the climax when Krishna says sarva dharman parityaja. But in one sense, it's really not. I mean, Krishna has made the same point throughout the Bhagavad Gita, many places where he says surrender to me and become my ninth chapter is all about devotional service. In fact, it says the heart of the Gita is the ninth chapter, or the tenth chapter too. The Chatushloki Bhagavad Gita. So the message is there throughout. But it kind of ends like, solid, you might say. In case you missed it, surrender to me. That's what this is all about. Yes, Trivikram.
Hari Bol. So you were saying like Atma has like many meanings. But if ordinary English word look like big, huge, enormous, great, gigantic, magnificent, so many meaning.
Yeah,
one word.
Well, that's
has.
True. English words are the same thing.
So it seems like all the words might have many meanings, but we may not know about them. But Krishna is expert, and he's very expert in.
But there are there are legitimate ways to translate the same Sanskrit words. Just like Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary in the first verse of the Bhagavatam, he gives five different commentaries on different levels, basically. First is like you might say prima facie, but you look at it, okay, this seems pretty clear what Krishna's saying here. But then he goes up higher, another step, oh no, finally he's talking about Radha Krishna, Gopi Bhava. They're all coming from the same, and he's explaining, he said, well, this word can mean this, this word can mean that. So that can be done. That kind of thing can be done by the great spiritual intellects, our acharyas. Yes, Sita Di Prabhu.
Yeah, no, the words, I mean, every word in every language, all forms of communication, they kind of take their meaning from the context that they're used.
Right.
I mean, if you look at the dictionary, they just sort of give you a list and there's no context. I mean, they give you... It could mean this, it could mean that. But and so when you're expressing it, it's in the context that the words take different shades of meaning. And of course, every author, they're writing for somebody. and they're kind of bringing the topic to that context of their readership. So yeah. Ramanuja was writing in whenever he was writing, 1300s. You know, and Prabhupada, you know, he's in a different cultural context, outreaching, connecting the message. So he wasn't just writing for us. He grew up in a certain context, and this is my preaching field and time. So that's natural for all the acharyas. You know, I mean, maybe some other acharya, he's dealing with a bunch of pundits, and they're all lost in the math or something. So he's talking to them in technicalities. So that's natural. That's natural. You know, it's not some message. I mean, you know, and then Krishna sometimes he hides, you know, you say he hides the stuff. Well, they don't want to hear it, you know. And also it is, and you just give them to it straight, and then they misconstrue it. So, you know, you sort of speak in diplomatic language so people are sincere will get it, and the idiots don't screw it up, you know. So, you know, these are, you know, it's like human beings are complicated, you know, except for us.
Okay, Manavati Prabhu.
Oh. Yeah, it's the take off from what Trivikram question was concerning the Atma, the different, you were talking about the different meanings of the Atma. Now, the question that I have here is, now we have the Atma and there is the Paramatma, Atma and Paramatma. Can you talk about if they are both sitting in our hearts, there is an Atma, there is the Paramatma, what is the difference between them, or is there any difference at all?
Well, there's a big difference. the individual jiva soul is Atma. Paramatma is God. So we're not God. The same Paramatma is in everyone's heart. I'm only in one. My little jiva is in one heart. This Paramatma is in everybody's heart. Sarvakshetreshu Bharata. Krishna talks about this at the beginning of the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. So he's all-knowing. He knows everything. He knows everyone's, he knows the jiva better than we know ourselves, all of them at the same time. So there are three aspects to the absolute, Vedanti tat tattva vidas. So one of them is Paramatma, he's God actually. So that Paramatma is in the heart, but witnessing.
The next question is then, where does the oneness and difference come in? In other words, we are one with God, but different, achintya veda veda tattva, so where does that come in?
Yeah, well, that's a big, big topic. The basic idea is that we're one in essence. We're made of the same stuff. Yes. That's the basic idea. The example is given, the sun and the sun's rays, or the ocean and a drop of ocean water. So maybe you just think of that example. Okay, a drop of ocean water is like the ocean, but you can't sail an ocean liner in a drop of water. There's no tamingala fish in a drop of water. So it's the same in one sense, but just because it's everywhere, we're minute, we're infinitesimal, Paramatma's infinite. So we're practically nothing, we're so small. And he's everywhere and everything. So we're, like I said, we're made of spirit, we're chit kana, particle of chit. Chit means spirit, or Brahman. Aham Brahmasmi. The Mayavadis, they like Aham Brahmasmi, it's one of their slogans. We also use it, but we think of it differently than they do, actually. It means I'm not this body. When they say I'm Brahmasmi, it means I'm God, basically. That's what they think. That's what they think when they say I'm Brahmasmi. Manamati Prabhu?
You brought up the story of Puranjan.
Yes.
And the soul and the wife being the intelligence. And I think in the commentary describes that the soul is attached to the intelligence. And you know, we think that our intelligence, we're attached to our intelligence, and we think our intelligence is, you know, the great intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And from your class, understanding that our intelligence really, like, is useless in some sense. And well, so what is the point of having intelligence in one sense? Because, you know, it's our intelligence, and we know what my intelligence is saying is the right thing, yeah? This is how we think. We're proud of our intelligence. But yet it seems like the intelligence is not something, especially in the process of bhakti, it's given, it's revealed. So I guess, yeah.
Well, intelligence is there. Actually, that's the greatest gift we have in human life, is that we have our intelligence. We can think, and we can hear from the Vedas, and we can decide. We can use our intelligence to understand and control the mind so that we can practice Krishna consciousness. Of course, Krishna says at the end of the Gita, you know, one who reads Bhagavad Gita worships me by his intelligence. So that's how we have to apply our intelligence. You're right. I mean, material intelligence, that's the idea. It's getting Pranjan in trouble. The idea is we misuse it in this material world. Dushkriti, right? And very intelligent. Maya parita jnana. People have such great intelligence, but they misuse it. So it has to be directed to Krishna. Then it's a great tool. It's a great tool to help us advance in Krishna consciousness. Apply our intelligence. It's like Prabhupada wanted us to apply our intelligence to how to preach Krishna consciousness in the Western world. So that's how it becomes something worthwhile. Otherwise, yeah, I guess it keeps us bound up here in the material world.
But our intelligence, there are people who, devotees who use intelligence, they read Srila Prabhupada's books, and they use their intelligence in such a such a wrong way, and that's their intelligence.
Yeah.
Sometimes it seems like it's really...
We're all vulnerable. We have the same tool, but we're vulnerable. It's like you have a knife, you can, you know, cut an apple with it or cut someone's throat with it. We're all vulnerable to misuse of the assets that Krishna has given us. Well, that happens. All right, we're over time. I'd like to end on time. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Sorry, Guru Prasad Prabhu. I'd like to end on time.